Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. I'm your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett.
Hey, Bill, have you been following the news on this Nexium cult lately?
I actually, under normal circumstances, that probably would not be something that would fall on my radar.
I'm surprised because they had sex slaves.
Well, I'm so busy with my own sex life. But what caught my attention is one of the people central to the case that is involved now is Allison Mack, and she was she is a television actress, but she was on a show that I watched for years, Smallville. She was in that. So when I saw her name, being the TV geek that I am, that got me first reading about it. And I think the second thing that attracted my attention was, how did they come up with that name and that pronunciation? I used to teach phonetic spelling, and it made me crazy trying to figure out how they got Nexium from the way they spell that word.
Sometimes I guess the V is the U. I don't know.
Yeah,
in
old Roman alphabet, yes, it is. But it just, the first time I looked at it, I thought, what are they saying there? And I had to actually read several articles to figure out how they pronounced it.
I thought Nexium was a medication.
Nexium is an actual, it is a heartburn medication, but it's spelled differently.
So this guy, Keith Raniere, something like that, they call him Vanguard.
Yes, rather.
So reading about it, he was a protege. He has some kind of a checkered past, was a schemer and this ripoff artist. And I guess he did something called Consumer's Byline, which was a pyramid scheme.
Correct.
And that didn't go so well for him. So he thought he would try that again. And then he started this Nexium with somebody, well, I guess with Nancy Salzman, who was a co-leader. Mm. And then that turned into a sex ring somewhere. And I'll be honest, I read a lot of stuff. I watched a lot of videos and I was having a hard time putting the pieces together. But it was really interesting to see another example of a cult. And since we have Dr. Janja Lelich on the show today, just wanted to, and it's interesting because she contacted me after we did the show, which of course we recorded a few weeks ago, and she said that the media is contacting her to ask questions. So we're going to get a lot of really good information from her today.
Yes.
One of the things that struck me, and I know we're going to talk about this a little bit later, is that I saw an interview with the attorney, and he was saying that the women had their own club.
Yes.
And it was being labeled as a sex ring. And he said, well, this is sexist, that these women are smart, they're intelligent, they're professionals. How could they possibly be involved in a cult? And of course, we talk about that when we talk to Dr. Lelich. So it's just an interesting thing to watch.
Right.
And compare that to where those of us who came out of religion, you know, are there similarities between cults?
Yes.
And what are they?
And I think that's what fascinated me the most as I was reading it, because as you said, it started out what they're now calling a pyramid scheme, but it was also a professional leadership type of buy-in. You would buy these seminar leadership, personal development, self-help seminars for, you know, around $5,000-$7,000 each. And it started out like that, but then the more somebody got into it, then it became actual mind and behavior control. And when I first read this, you know, even before we interviewed Dr. Janja, I would have never pegged it as a cult. But then researching for our interview with her was the first time I'd ever heard anybody give that showed me that a cult is not always and exclusively religious.
Right.
And so her four signals for a cult, what she calls bonded, just opened my eyes. And so when I read this, I thought, she knows this. She taught me this. So I'm really looking forward to the interview today, because stories like this and incidents like this, it just connects, because you see the similarities in what we know as the traditional religious cult. Right. And then something like this that, you know, controlled people's behavior. And like you said, How why would they do this? These are smart people. Why did they do this? How would they allow themselves? Because it was vicious what they were doing.
Right. And somebody else said that they said you get into this cult. It's this leadership thing that they walk you through. Mm-hmm. And then it says you have issues, but we're going to help heal you. We're going to make you feel better about yourself. We're going to help you overcome these obstacles in your life. And then, of course, you want to hang out with us because once you go out into the real world and you see these people who don't have it together, they're going to drag you down. They're going to drag you back into that place mm-hmm. that is not healthy yes. for you. And of course, I couldn't help but compare that to in church where it was be in the world, but not of the world.
Of the world, yes.
You want to stay in the church. You want to stay mm-hmm. safe. You want to stay in this place where God is moving and God is changing your life and God is going to make everything okay.
Yeah.
And it translates really well into other cultic environments.
Yeah. Our sense of holiness evolved then into a sense of isolation, which became incubation.
Yes.
We were totally protected from all of that. And that's what happened in as I've followed this case and I'm listening to some of the testimony and listening to the defense attorney, I was just cracking up. Because of all things, one of the things that struck me, he quoted from my favorite book in the whole world, To Kill a Mockingbird, he quoted Atticus Finch in defending this guy. So I was like livid as I was reading that. But they did. They isolated these women. They got them to continually lose weight because this leader liked very thin women, and they would get just morbidly thin. Because that's what he liked, because they wanted to please him. And so, like you said, there was this group of women, but then there was also another kind of segment in there that was, you know, the men, and they were very misogynist and made fun of the women and shamed them and ridiculed them, which is, again, part of behavior control.
Yeah, it totally is. Well, let's jump right into the interview because I think we have a longer interview than normal today. So,
well, we couldn't stop asking her questions.
No, we couldn't.
She's so fascinating.
She's fascinating. It's a great interview. So let's get to it.
Dr. Yanya Lalich is a researcher, author, and educator specializing in cults and extremist groups with a particular focus on charismatic relationships, political and other social movements, ideology and social control, and issues of gender and sexuality. She is a professor emerita of sociology at California State University, Chico. Dr. Lalich is also the founder and director of the Center for Research on Influence and Control. Her books include Escaping Utopia, Growing Up in a Cult, Getting Out, and Starting Over, Take Back Your Life, Recovering from Cults and Abusive Relationships and Bounded Choice, True Believers, and Charismatic Cults. But not without scars. Yanya has a fascinating tale of her own to tell. And Yanya, thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, well, thanks, Tim, for inviting me.
We are very glad to have you here. I have so many questions.
We have a lot of questions. And I have to say, thank you for coming back. We tried to do this before, and the show didn't go so well with our technical issues. So I appreciate your patience and kindness.
Well, no problem.
So tell us about yourself. Tell us your background, how you got involved with what you're doing, and your experiences.
Okay, how much time do we have?
Hours. We can do this for hours.
We have nothing to do. Go on.
Okay. Well, in the mid-70s, I had just moved to San Francisco after having lived in Europe for about 4.5 years on a Spanish island, which I wish I had never left. But anyway, so I was new in town. I was making new friends, and this was sort of the post-Vietnam War era. And, you know, I met a woman who was a friend of a roommate, and we would have these great political discussions over coffee. And eventually she invited me to join a study group, which I thought, oh, well, that's a great thing. I can meet some new people, and, you know, I'm sort of have an intellectual bent. And so I joined the study group, and after a few weeks, she asked to meet with me again and told me that there was an organization behind the study group and wouldn't I like to join? So basically, I thought, sure, you know, why not? It was I was in my 30s. It was a time in my life when I really wanted to do something to create social change. And this seemed like a really good thing. And I knew some of the people who were involved. And so it seemed trustworthy. And that was it. I got initiated and spent the next 10 and a half years in this very corrupt, very disciplined organization. I was mostly in leadership most of that time. And so I really saw the inner workings and was around the leader a lot. The leader happened to be a woman. And yeah, it was a very tough life. We worked 20-hour days, 7 days a week, year after year. Everybody was exhausted and pretty much brain dead and had no contact really with anyone who wasn't in the group. And when I got out, basically we all got out. We had the group imploded. We it's a long story, but anyway, we expelled our leader and we dissolved the organization. And so I was about 41 years old and I moved to New York in order to be as far away from San Francisco as I could and basically was a mess. I mean, I couldn't read the front page of a newspaper without my eyes going bleary and I was terrified and I was paranoid and I was crying all the time. But I got a job. I worked my job. I did what I could and tried to figure out what the heck had happened to me, that I had sort of become this mean, awful person while I was in that group. And so I started looking at the literature about cults and everything at that time. There wasn't a lot, but there was about religious cults. And I had been in a political group. So it took me a while to figure out that, yeah, I was in a cult too. It just wasn't religious. And so that's how I got into this field. I started studying and reading and going to conferences and eventually went to graduate school and got my PhD and sort of made this decision to turn a bad thing into a good thing by doing whatever I can to educate the public about the dangers and the risks of these kinds of groups.
One of the things that I found fascinating as I was reading some of your story, and admittedly, I've heard a couple of your interviews, some of your that are on YouTube and in articles. And one of the things that fascinated me that I had never thought about, and you were just talking about it with this political group, I had never thought about cults not being religious. And you opened my eyes to the reality that cults can be and are more than just religious based.
Absolutely. I mean, a cult can be formed around any kind of belief system. So, you know, it's all kinds of New Age cults, meditation cults, business cults. Probably there's a chocolate chip cookie cult. I don't, you know, it's cults are really about the.
I'm joining the chocolate chip cookie. I'm doing that one.
Okay, but cults are really about behaviors and how people are exploited and manipulated, and the belief system or the ideology is just one of the tools that the cults use to basically control people and keep them in line.
What really struck me about your story was that you weren't some kid that came off the street. You know, you were 30 years old, a Fulbright scholar. What happened? If you can kind of talk about where you were and where the other people were, what were they like that you worked with?
Well, they were mostly people my age. The leader was a little bit older. And the leader had a PhD, and so that was constantly in our face, you know, that she was this brilliant, she was the new Lenin. And we recruited through friendship networks, which is a way a lot of groups recruit. So people kind of knew each other, joined because their friends were joining. The headquarters was in San Francisco, and in the beginning, we stayed underground while we did the most intense sort of training and indoctrination. And then eventually we sort of surfaced and started doing various political work around the Bay Area. But people were, you know, they were do-gooders. They were people who wanted to change society. I mean, we said we were fighting against racism and sexism and classism, and, you know, we were going to create a better world. And we sort of had this long view that, you know, eventually we wanted there to be a revolution, but we didn't think it would happen in our lifetime. You know, we thought we were martyrs for the cause, you know, building relationships with working class people and minorities in order to, you know, set up an environment that would eventually have a revolution. You know, that was the pitch. That was the, but that's not what we did. I mean, what we did was basically anything that led to the aggrandizement of our leader. So that's
well, you mentioned the you were against sexism and racism and classism, and those are all good causes to be working against. How is it that within that, it turned kind of malevolent?
Well, it actually started out malevolent, although we didn't know it. I mean, you know, it's true of every cult. I mean, the belief system might be all well and good. And when you join, of course, you don't know the bottom line from the beginning. You know, when I first joined, I thought, wow, this is great. You know, I found something. We had all kinds of rules and regulations and security rules. But, you know, that just made it seem like we were that much more serious. You know, I thought, and so did all the others, you know, that we were really the elite. You know, we were in the forefront of creating this movement across America. Eventually, we had people around the country in five or six other cities. And, you know, we built a lot of front organizations that we used for recruiting. And it takes time to realize that you joined something that wasn't what it said it was. And in the beginning, you're so enthralled with the whole thing. And then, of course, in our group, I mean, like I said earlier, we worked so hard. If people had a job, the minute they got out of their workplace, they reported to one of our facilities. People worked until 11 or 12 at night. Then we went home and we had reports to write. And on the weekends, we had these, you know, starting on Friday night, we had these 10-hour meetings. And of course, everyone was exhausted. And after a while, you can't really think straight. You're sort of an automaton.
What I'm fascinated by, though, is we're not talking about people who, like me, I was raised in evangelical Christianity. Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't much of a thought process for me to stay or leave. It just was what it was. But we're talking about educated people. We're talking about mm-hmm. people that had higher thinking, higher learning. And so, you know, what I hear is that being in a cult, really, that doesn't really matter, right? I mean, it doesn't really matter what level of education you have, that there's still a possibility of kind of being sucked into something that you're not aware of what's happening to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's important to understand, first of all, two-thirds of people who get recruited into cults are recruited by either a friend, a family member, or a coworker, right? So again, you're being drawn in by someone you know and presumably trust. So that makes the recruitment process a little easier for the group. And secondly, education is important to many groups. I mean, groups want people who will perform for them, right? The cults want you to run their businesses, to do their public relations, you know, I ran the publishing house in our group. You know, they don't want lazy, crazy people. You know, I mean, if somebody shows any signs of sort of mental illness, in most cases, the cult will get rid of that person because, you know, you're there to take care of the cult and the leader. The cult's not there to take care of you. And so cults look for people who can bring them that kind of legitimacy and run things and build things and bring in new contacts. And in fact, today, you know, most of the people being recruited are in their 30s and 40s. They're not young kids. I mean, there are still some groups who recruit on college campuses. I mean, I don't want to imply that they don't recruit young people. But most cults, I think they've learned and they've adapted and they see that they fare better if they recruit someone who's older. Because first of all, their family isn't going to come after them like families do when someone younger gets involved in something. And so the calls that I get and the queries that I get are often from people of that age, you know, and it's often like a husband or a wife calling about their spouse. Sometimes it's even children calling about their parents. And it's not so much the young kids.
And we know that cults center around a person and personality. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that they like educated people. But one thing you said earlier, how much they worked you and how hard you worked and the exhaustion. Isn't exhaustion something that cult leaders usually like and can play on?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when people are exhausted, they can't think straight. And, you know, one of the goals of every cult during indoctrination is to basically shut down your critical thinking abilities. So if you're too tired to even think straight, you're not going to be able to formulate questions or sort of focus on what your hesitations may be or what might look like a problem. So working people very hard, or in some cases, it might be using some kind of practice, meditating for hours and hours and hours, speaking in tongues, chanting, you know, those kinds of things often for long periods of time will have the same effect as someone being exhausted.
So when you have these people entering these cults, and I'm drawing comparisons to religion, which is my background, but I know that they come from different places. There's still that aspect of bowing to this leader that creates this level of shame. Mm-hmm. What are the characteristics of the leaders, and how do people respond to those leaders? Is there a pattern that you've seen?
Well, the leaders are essentially people who are power hungry, who like to control, who are authoritarian and domineering. They're people who are generally narcissistic. Everything's about them and having their needs yet. But, you know, a sort of aura is built up around the leader. And so, you know, we think of that as charisma. We call these people charismatic leaders. And charisma is essentially a social relationship. People think charisma is, oh, there's this person who is inherently has these gifts to reach people and connect with people. And yes, they may be charming, they may be bright, they may be glib, you know, quick of tongue, but it's about how you respond to that person, right? It's a social relationship. And that's why some people may look at some leader and just swoon and think they're wonderful. And then the person sitting next to them might think, this guy's a total con artist, right? So it's how the audience or the followers respond to that person that creates this charismatic relationship, which is a relationship of power and of a power imbalance. So that once you attribute that type of characteristic, once you decide, oh my God, this is this incredibly awesome leader who has these special powers, who has a special message, who is the only one who can put us on this path to salvation or revolution or whatever it might be, losing weight, making more money, whatever, you're then under the sway of that person, and that person has a great deal of power over you. And of course, it's important that these leaders immediately gain followers, right? If you're some guy who's standing on a soapbox and you're preaching, you know, Jesus is coming tomorrow, and you think you're, you know, some kind of special person, and nobody responds to you, well, A, you're not a charismatic leader, you have no followers. It's important for the leader to immediately gather up faithful, true believer followers. And those are the people who then go out and recruit, right? And they make the group grow. And they carry the message, and they convey to other people, you know, the story about the leader, right? And so they're operating by what we call charisma by proxy, right? Hmm. They're carrying out the orders and wishes of the leader, and they're imparting to the followers that this is this incredibly special person that you have to honor and obey and be ready to die for.
Yeah.
So that structure, setting up that structure with various levels of leadership, is very important for the group to grow and for the group to continue. You know, in some groups, people never even see the leader. Even in my group, which was relatively small, toward the end, there were members who never saw the leader because she was off in another city drunk all the time, right? And so, you know, and we were just saying, oh, you know, that she was the cat's meow. So it's important to have set up that structure where others, the lieutenants, the middle management, whatever you want to call them, that they're able to keep conveying this specialness about the leader.
When you talk about the personality of leaders, it was interesting that you talked about what some people will see as a charismatic leader, others will look at and say, I don't get it. And mm-hmm. I remember in an earlier episode, we had a young man who worked and was very involved with the Bill Gothard organization, which I also was involved with years ago. And Bill Gothard had a very meek and mild personality, very soft-spoken, never raised his voice. And I remember so many people like myself were just enamored by him. And then friends of mine would say, I don't understand that. He strikes me as dull and boring, but he had such a following. So mm-hmm. I appreciate that you talked about that not everybody is going to find the leader as just somebody that you're just, everybody is drawn to. And I've recognized over years that I have something in me, some personality trait that I'm drawn to. You know, my involvement in early fundamentalism is, which is cultic. I realized actually after reading some of your material, Yanya, that I used to work for a cultic work organization, not even a religious organization, but it was very cultic, I see now. Mm-hmm. So I have that personality that I can be attracted to that. So I appreciate that it's not always the person you think, oh, I understand why everybody likes that person.
Exactly. And that, I think that's why it's hard for outsiders to understand, you know, some of the things that cult members do that just seem incomprehensible, you know, giving away their children, you know, it's probably the worst example, but, you know, sort of carrying out misdeeds, lying, you know, those things that normally you would think this person would never do that. And suddenly they get involved in a group and they kind of throw out their own sense of morality. And people on the outside have a hard time understanding sort of the power of that social system and the power of, you know, what I call the self-sealing system. It's a group that's closed in on itself, and you're basically living in another reality.
In some of the churches, there isn't always a charismatic leader or really much of a leader at all, for that matter. But it seems like people get involved in the church, they get established with their families or meeting other members of the church, and so there are then standards by which we have to adhere once we're in the organization. And we, you know, for example, in my family, we would, of course, go out to lunch or go out to dinner with other families. So there was just this code of behavior that we all adhered to without really talking about it. It was just there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it's difficult sometimes to say, well, this organization is a cult and that organization is not a cult, even though they bear some similarities. What is the threshold when you're looking at an organization? It may not necessarily be the leader, but the ideologies or the dogmas behind it. What is the threshold? How do you determine if you're in a cult or you're not?
Well, I think, you know, especially with religion, religious cults, you know, I always say a healthy religion is not going to control your life every minute of the day. A healthy religion is not going to have you sort of worshiping this living human being in front of you, but you're going to be worshiping some kind of higher principle, you know, whether it's God or Allah or a tree or, you know, whatever it might be. And also a healthy religion may have guidelines for living, right? Like they may say, be kind to your neighbor. When someone moves into your neighborhood, you know, take them a cake and welcome them. But they don't come and check up on you and actually see if you've taken that person a cake, right? But an unhealthy religion will do that, will set up, you know, disciplines and ways of living and punishments, and people will be, in a sense, spying on each other and reporting on each other. And there's a great deal of fear. And a lot of it is sort of carried out through peer pressure. I mean, peer pressure is a very big influence in our lives.
Right.
So if everybody else is doing it and you're thinking, I don't know, you're not likely to speak out. You're likely to, you know, do in Rome as the Romans do, as we say, right? So that kind of peer pressure, and especially if your whole family is involved, you know, it's very difficult to be the odd one out, right? And so that kind of influence is part of what helps keep it together and keep people in line.
So just to follow up, so, you know, if I was that person who felt like I should bring the cake over to the neighbor, but I didn't do it, and even if there's nobody following up with me to say, hey, did you take the cake over there? Instead, there is that feeling of guilt. I didn't take the cake. I should have taken the cake.
Right.
Something that I guess, you know, be even maybe more relevant is how many people did you witness to? How many people did you share the gospel with? We don't talk about those numbers because those numbers are really low. Right? So instead of talking about the numbers, we just feel really bad that we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. And again, it's not even overt. It's just this this feeling of I'm in this social circle, this social setting, and I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. not realizing that nobody else is not doing what they're supposed to do either.
Right.
So you just have this feeling of guilt and shame, and mm-hmm. that becomes part of the culture.
Yes, absolutely.
Is that still considered cultic, or is that personal?
No, absolutely. I mean, cults and cult leaders and cult trainers are very good at preying on basic human emotions, right? They're not doing anything unusual. They're using basic social psychological techniques, right? They're preying on guilt and shame and love and fear and anger and, you know, all these things that throughout our lives we've learned how to respond to, right? So guilt and shame are probably two of the biggest ones. And once the member has been indoctrinated to the point where they have internalized, right? They've internalized the belief system and they've internalized the culture. They've internalized the ways in which one is supposed to operate to be in the good graces of that particular church or organization. It doesn't take someone else to berate you. You're berating yourself all the time. You're beating yourself up because you feel that you have, you know, betrayed or disgraced or brought shame to, and or you're not living up to the ideal.
Right.
And of course, the ideal is always an impossible ideal. So it's a complete setup. But absolutely, it's a self-imposed discipline after a period of time. And then, of course, there will also be examples that are set. You know, there will be public humiliation, public chastising, you know, using yes. someone as an example to sort of reinforce the internal discipline that each member is supposed to have.
Do people who are in cults know that they're in cults?
Did you know?
I mean, I wasn't wanting to be. This isn't about me for one time.
No, I don't think people know they're in cults. I mean, I think once someone has that realization, if they do, then that's when they try to figure out how to get out. I mean, nobody knowingly joins a cult. You know, you join something that you think is going to have some benefit for you or your family or your life in some way. And even though the outside world may be, you know, writing articles or doing exposés and saying such and such a group is a cult, and of course the cult will do damage control, you know, say, oh, well, that's just Satan doing that, or, you know,
yes.
whatever, right? They'll find some way to, you know, to have you not pay any attention to that, you know, and in some cases the group is so completely sequestered, they don't even know what the outside world is saying about them. But no, people don't realize they're in a cult. I mean, in my case, when I did, I mean, I in my case, I'll give you an example. I was in for about 6 years at a point where of something really traumatic happened in that my mother died. And I'm not going to go into the whole story because it's so upsetting to me. But after my mother died and the way I was treated at that time in the cult, I became like a dead person. I wanted to get out. I would get up every morning and I'd go and take a shower and I would cry and cry and cry because we weren't allowed to cry. And I would get in my car and I would drive to my facility where I worked and I would pray that I would have a car accident, right? That I would get killed in a car accident. It was the only way I could see to get out. And I was completely miserable. Right. And I kept trying to plan escapes and I couldn't do it. I couldn't figure out how to do it. I knew they'd come after me because I knew so much. I was in the inner circle. And I was just paralyzed. Right. I was just paralyzed with fear. And that started in 1981. And it wasn't until late 1985 that the group finally imploded and we all got out. And so I suffered like that for 4 years. And I will submit to you that there are probably thousands and thousands of people who are experiencing that same thing. They know, I didn't voice in my mind, I didn't think it was a cult. I just knew I was miserable. I knew it was corrupt. I knew it was wrong. But I didn't think about it as a cult until at some point, a number of us sort of broke the code of silence and looked at each other and said, we're in a cult. And then we all, you know, then we made our move and got out, but, and got everybody out. But, so people, while they're in it, they may not have the words for it, but they're awfully miserable. Being in a cult is generally not a happy experience.
Yes.
As you probably know.
Yeah. From several of my experiences in that. And you talked about that people probably don't know they are. And I do think that that often we don't realize we were in a cult until time and distance gives us enough perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody walked up to you, or can I walk up to somebody, if I look at it and I see what's going on and I see all the earmarks of a cult, is it beneficial for me to just walk up and say, dude, you're in a cult?
No. And that's because of the damage control that probably the cult has already done. You know, they've warned people, you know, people are going to come to you and they're going to try to get you away from this. They're going to tell you lies. They're going to say we're a cult, and it's because they don't understand that we're actually the elite on our way to, you know, the pearly gates. The thing to do is really try, if you have contact with someone who's in a group, is to try to have very soft conversations that ask questions in very gentle ways that will try to, as we say, reawaken those critical thinking abilities. And so you don't want to bombard them. If you want to befriend them, you want to give them the understanding that you're always there for them, that you may not understand what you're doing, but you respect it. But you also feel that if ever they want to leave, that your home would be a safe haven. It would be someplace they could come to. Because that's the hardest thing about leaving. I mean, if you start to think about leaving, you don't know where to go, right? You think, you know, you don't know who to trust.
Your life and your identity is tied
right,
up in
exactly.
It.
And you don't know who to trust. You think, I mean, I thought I was just going to die in the streets if I left, because that's what we told everybody, you know, that we were these dirty communists and no one would want us, you know, so why go out there in the world? And all groups are going to have some way that they portray the outside as evil, right? When I did my last research, where I interviewed 65 people who grew up in cults, it's in that book, Escaping Utopia. The thing almost every person said, the thing that blew them away when they got out was how nice people were in the outside world, right? Because they expected it to be this awful, cruel place, you know, and they found just the opposite. So if you have contact with someone in a group, it's important to just stay in touch with them. Try to give them reminders of what life is really like on the outside. You know, if you're a family member, you know, send them pictures of family gatherings, you know, whatever you can do to sort of spark memories and sort of let them know there really is another way to live.
We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
I'm Gail Jordan, Executive Director of Recovering from Religion. Thank you for listening to our podcast. Recovering from Religion is an online community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. We're not here to talk you out of or into faith. We just provide a safe place to examine what you believe and perhaps why you believe it. We have staff who can take your calls and chats, and we can help connect you with an evidence-based therapist in your area. On our website, you'll find an extensive database of resources, as well as where to find local support groups in many communities. We want to help you resolve issues around your faith. Recovering from Religion is an entirely volunteer-run organization. If you're interested in being a volunteer, please visit recoveringfromreligion.org and look for the Volunteer tab. Also, we invite you to support us with a monthly or one-time donation. All contributions go directly to fund Recovering from Religion programs and outreach efforts. On our website, click on the Donate button for instruction.
Many of us that are recovering from religion know that changes to our beliefs about God create doubt and uncertainty. We too have found ourselves without a community and lacking guidance. With this in mind, we've developed the Recovering from Religion Fall Excursion. We will be debuting this event in the tranquil mountains of North Carolina, where the stars are bright and the air is clear and fresh. Join us for workshops on embracing healthy sexuality, leaving fears of hell behind, yoga, a guided hike from our very own Dr. Daryl Ray, stargazing, wine and cider tasting, campfires, music, great food, and of course, great company. The on-site lodges are comfortable and modern, and our registration includes all meals and activities. Tickets and lodging are limited, so register early at recoveringfromreligion.org for our first ever fall excursion, September 20th through the 22nd. Free from judgment and free from dogma, rediscover yourself.
I have a question about your book, which is titled Bounded Choice. Can you explain what that means?
Bounded Choice came out of the research that I did for my dissertation when I was getting my PhD. And so the book Bounded Choice is kind of a user-friendly version of my doctoral dissertation. What I came to see through that research, which was a comparative study of the group I was in and the Heaven's Gate cult, which was the group that had mass suicide or murder, whichever way you want to look at it, in the mid-90s. Bounded choice is basically the state of mind that a person comes to once they're fully indoctrinated, where they are enclosed in what I call this bounded reality, right? This self-sealing system. And they themselves become a self-sealing system in a sense that they have, as I spoke about earlier, internalized the beliefs and the approved behaviors of being in the cult. Once you get to that point, because of all the pressures on you and because you have so internalized the system, you get to this place of bounded choice, which means that when you have a decision to make, you know exactly the choice that you have to make in order to stay within the good graces of the group, right? So And this addresses the issue of free will, because it's something that comes up all the time. Like, well, you have free will, right? Nobody's holding a gun to your head. You know, nobody's going to kill you if you try to leave, although in some groups they do, but that's a different issue. But in fact, when you get to that point in your mind, your free will is actually altered and subsumed under the will of the leader and the will of the organization. So that the choices you make are, in a sense, predetermined, and you essentially have what I call the illusion of choice. So I'm talking here about, you know, life choices. I'm not talking about, you know, what kind of car you're going to buy or what you're going to eat for dinner or things like that. I'm talking about big life choices that are essentially not accessible to you in an honest, free will kind of way, because you are so controlled and so influenced by groupthink.
I know Bill and I and other former XK leaders will get emails and we get hit up on social media about how could you mm-hmm. dare stay in conversion therapy, not just go through it, but become a leader in it and do what you did and do it for so long. And when I read about Bounded Choice, I thought that was my life. I grew up in the Pentecostal Church of God. I didn't know any better. I didn't know anything else. And when I felt like God had changed me or was changing me, I grabbed onto that and I pushed the cognitive dissonance away. So that was my only choice, was to stay right in the ministry and to keep doing what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But I also find it interesting that if you talk to someone, and again, I'm going to use the evangelical church, but you could replace that with Jehovah's Witnesses or whatever. When you talk to someone who's in it, it's impossible to get them to, or nearly impossible to get them to come to a conclusion, right? Because, and I use my parents as an example, is that if I start to question certain beliefs, mm-hmm. eventually they're going to shrug their shoulders and say, well, that's what the Bible says, or that's what God said, and he'll figure it out at the end. But there's no logical conclusion to it. How do you see this working in other groups? Can you kind of expand on what that bounded choice looks like? And is there a way to escape it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in any group, it's going to be the same thing. It's like you may have questions. You may think I'm going to speak up, but you know, if you speak up, you're going to get obliterated. You know that it's impossible to question and challenge. Because certainly throughout all the time that you were in the group, you learned that was impossible by seeing what happened to people who did, right? So it's the same thing. It's whatever the ideology is or whatever the leader of that group is saying becomes gospel, right? And so people are completely closed off. I mean, again, I can say from my own experience, I mean, there were times when I did speak out and I took the consequences. You know, I got just blasted. We would have these trials, you know, sort of like the trials in Stalin's Russia, right? You'd have to sit up in front of everybody and these charges would be brought against you and everybody would have to speak out and berate you and criticize you and humiliate you. And you'd had to sit there and take it. And these trials sometimes went on for hours and you had to sit there stone-faced. You couldn't cry. You couldn't express any emotion. And then the panel, whoever was leading this, would, you know, come up with some kind of judgment, you know, that either you were demoted or you were, you know, whatever the punishment. In some cases, people were expelled. And so all of these things are sort of teaching lessons, right, that show people that it's impossible. And you get to that point where I think you just shut mm-hmm. down, right? You just think, I mean, like I was saying earlier, the door was there. I could not walk out that door. You know, the door wasn't locked, but I could not walk out that door.
Right.
I mean, you get to the point where it's literally impossible to imagine life outside the cult.
Yeah. It becomes the way you see the world. It becomes the way you think.
And in a sense, you resign yourself to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's sort of like, you know, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
Right. Yeah.
And you just say, well, you know, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is my life. If I leave, what if I'm wrong? What if they really are right? You know, all this, you know, mishigaskas on in your head.
Too afraid to make the choice, too afraid to ask the questions. And
that was one of the questions that came up when I did my 2014 book was, they said, did you ever at any point say to yourself, oh no, I am gay? And that sent me in this tailspin because I realized I could not say that because that went against my beliefs, my ideologies. Everything that I believed about the Bible to be true came into question if I were to say, wait a minute, I might be gay. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, like you're saying, I think we get bound into that place where it's not just, oh, my eyes are open and this is a cult. My world fell apart when I came to that conclusion.
Right. And that's very scary.
Yeah.
Very scary. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm very similar to Tim. And when I came to that choice of admitting I was gay, I almost committed suicide. I was in a room by myself with a gun in my hand.
Wow.
Because I had no frame of reference. I had no theological placeholder for that. It went against everything that I believed, everything I had worked for. My family, my ministry, everything would be gone if I just made that statement to myself, I'm gay. So it is this closed system that affects everything we see. I was going to say, one of my favorite writers is C.S. Lewis, his fiction that he writes. And in the last book of the Chronicles of Narnia, there's a scene where everybody goes into a barn. And most people just see this vast open world there. But there's a few people, a few of the creatures who only see a barn because that's what they thought they would see when they got in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so their mind was conditioned. There's a barn. I'm going to see a barn. And so they saw a barn. Mm-hmm. And other people, their minds were open up to what, you know, to what else is out there. In your materials on bonded choices, you actually talk about four characteristics of that. Can you go over those four for us? Because I found them so interesting.
Yeah, sure. So the four characteristics or factors that for me comprise this self-sealing system or the structure, the internal structure of a cult, is first of all, of course, the charismatic authority, right? So that's the leader. That's the person who runs everything and who everybody adores and worships. Secondly, there's what I call the transcendent belief system. And again, this doesn't have to be religious, but it's a belief system that's transcendent in the sense that it gives you the answers to everything. It gives you the answers to the past, the present, and the future, right? And it offers you some path to, you know, some desired place, you know, whether that's religious salvation, a political solution, a personal improvement, you know, whatever it might be. And that transcendent belief system has within it the guidance of this charismatic leader who essentially invented that belief system. And then those two things are supported and brought together by the next two factors. One is what I call the systems of control, and the other one is called the systems of influence. And what was unique about my research and about this framework is that no one before had separated or looked at the difference between controls and influences. So the systems of control are obviously the rather overt rules and regulations. You know, it might be a dress code, a speaking code, you know, things you can and cannot do, security guidelines, you know, whatever, assignments, you know, all of that stuff that's very out in the open. But the systems of influence are those more subtle things. And that's where the peer pressure comes in. And that's where modeling comes in, where older members will model for you how to behave. And that's where some of the more subtle training comes in, because it's not overt, so that you're sort of learning by watching and learning by doing. And so those four things are intertwined. They all support and reinforce each other to create this self-sealing system that essentially you're stuck in the middle of. And it's a very powerful structure. And that's why when people say, why didn't you leave? You know, why did you do what you did? Well, it was impossible. You were living within, you know, a kind of prison-like atmosphere. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's easy for someone on the outside to say, you know, why didn't you say no? Why didn't you run away? But you are completely enveloped by the strength and the power of this interlocking system.
Mm-hmm. And I get that on Facebook a lot, because I am critical of fundamentalism and that kind of background, and I write a lot about it, exposing it. But I still get people who say I'm soft on it, because when they come in and just make sweeping statements, you know, why can they believe that? How are they so stupid? Mm-hmm. And I will try to say, because that's what they believe, that's what they see, that's what they've been taught, that's the world they live in. And so on one hand, I think we can be critical to seek to expose it, but I still try to separate the people that are involved in it and not call them into question as far as their character or their, you know, their intelligence.
Right.
And this is a great segue to talk about politics.
Yeah, I was just going to say, this is Trumpism.
Well, yes. Yeah.
You know, I was going to say, for those of us on the outside, and I was a raging Republican when I left the church, because, again, that just like my Christianity, that's how I was raised, and the two were becoming one during my lifetime. So after I left, well, even after I came out, and even after my my book Going Gay came out, I was still pretty conservative at that time. And it was a slower process to start to untangle what all of that meant and how the Republican Party worked. And, you know, eventually I became a raging liberal. But in the meantime, looking at people who have become these major Trump supporters and even going against the morals and values of their own religion, it has become another cult-like movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What would you say is the best way to address family and friends and people who are so swept away in this guy is all that and he's right and the media is against him and the media is lying to us? I mean, how would you respond to that?
Oh boy, I wish I had the answer.
I do too.
I struggle with this every day.
I really thought you were going to solve this problem for us today.
I have a pin in my hand and everything.
I mean, I do believe education is one way. But it's a problem. I mean, people are, you know, so enclosed in their world with Fox News and not being particularly educated. Although I know plenty of educated people who are also in that world.
Yes,
you know? Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So it's not just, you know, what some might think of as, you know, the dumb white trash.
Right.
But I think that all we can do is keep building on our side, you know, keep,
yeah.
creating organizations that fight against racism and fight against misogyny and sexism and arrest the really crazy ones, like that militia guy who just got arrested down at the border.
Right.
You know, show them that you can't get away with this, even though it looks like you can right now. And, you know, I think we have to build our movement in order to counter that movement. And I think people don't see it as a movement, the other side, but it is. It's a vast social movement, and it's extremely cultic.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't have an answer. I wish I did. If I did, I'd probably be very rich because I could write a book that would sell a million.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I don't know that there. I'm like Tim. I was very conservative when I was in the ministry, and although I was raised to believe in the real separation of church and state, so I did not talk about politics in the pulpit. I actually got a call one day from Pat Robertson's organization when he was running for president, and they wanted Pat to come speak at my church, and I refused.
Okay.
But I think one of the things that has surprised me the most in the past almost 3 years with the election of this president has been watching the faith that I grew up in just ignore the things that I was taught growing
right.
up
yeah. Right.
In favor of accepting this person and this leadership, because when I was growing up, Trump would have been the example preached from the pulpit of everything we should not be and should not do.
Right.
And now he's embraced.
Right.
So it's.
And well, you know, they're getting what they want. You know, they're
yes.
getting this fight against abortion.
Yes.
If he has his way, that'll, you know, Roe v. Wade will get overturned.
Right.
I mean, they're able to voice all their racist feelings that they've squelched all these years, you know, because of so-called political correctness. I think the way the churches have responded is probably one of the most stunning things for most people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's broken my heart. I mean, it has been, it makes me ill, literally ill, to watch it and try to explain it, because I write about politics and religion. I get asked the question a lot. And I'm like you. I wished I could explain it. I read a lot of books and materials on it, but I just can't reconcile how I was raised, what I was taught, with what I'm seeing now.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's a grab for political power, which they currently have, but they're a minority. You know, we forget the fact that this is a dwindling group of people who are continually becoming more of a minority. And as the religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, and atheists and agnostics and people who don't hold to their point of view, as well as more liberal Christians, we have more voting power, but they've had a concerted effort for the last 50 years and it has paid off. They've gotten where they wanted to go. But you're right, Bill. It's. I think at one point I felt embarrassed. I felt embarrassed that I had been a part of that or what it had become, mm-hmm. or to see somebody like Paula White, you know, who's the whatever, name it, claim it kind of preacher,
yes.
You know, people on the outside don't discriminate between Paula White and our little churches, you know, around the country that don't believe that. They disassociate all of this, all of our evangelical history with Paula White and politics. And I guess the good side of that is that people are turning their back. They are waking up. They are leaving it. They're questioning it. And as, you know, LGBT rights become more popular, even people in the evangelical churches are supportive of gay marriage and all that means. So there is a change,
mm-hmm.
but it is baffling.
It is. Mm-hmm. And to be associated, because as a person who still sees myself as a person of faith and write about that as well, I got a letter 2 weeks ago from somebody in Australia just blasting me because they saw something I had written being a person of faith and then associated it with people like Paula White, and they just could not reconcile. And so they judged me by that. So it is embarrassing. And it's why I do not come out and identify myself with terms like Christian or believer or any of those, because I just don't want to be associated with that shit. I just do not want people to see me in that way. My faith is very personal. My faith is my faith. And it's not that. but I don't want to spend my whole conversation explaining what I'm not.
Mm-hmm. You know,
I got off the subject, didn't I?
I just want to mention a book that I found really quite incredible on this topic. And maybe you've read it. I don't know. It's called Rising Out of Hatred. And I forget the author, but it's about a young man who was the son of the founder of that website, Stormfront. And so he was raised and absolutely entrenched and one of the heroes of the white supremacist movement. And as he got older, he decided to go to college. And for some bizarre reason, he picked this nice liberal arts college in the South somewhere. And the various students on campus who befriended him eventually began to change his mind. And he ended up having a Jewish girlfriend. And it's an incredible story. And
it's Eli Saslov.
Yes, that's it.
He's not the guy.
He wrote about the young man.
He wrote the book. And so if anybody's looking for the book, that's the author's name.
Yeah, it's an incredible book. But I guess what it says is that, you know, we kind of have to do this on a one-by-one basis, you know, that we can try to change people and get them to see the flaws in their thinking, because he then eventually, you know, renounces that world. Yeah. And his father. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's an amazing story. And it's one of the few things that kind of gave me hope in the last few months. So.
And we need that. And we need that. Speaking of books, I don't want us to leave without talking about your latest book, Escaping Utopia, which is fascinating because I think it is groundbreaking in the research, because you've done what so few, I don't know if anyone's done it as far as the research sampling. Tell us about Escaping Utopia.
Sure. Escaping Utopia is based on research I did while I was a professor at Chico State. I interviewed 65 individuals who were either born in or raised from a very early age in a cult, and who then left the cult essentially on their own without any outside help. And so I was looking at their life in the cult, but also how they were able to adjust to the quote outside world. So these 65 individuals were from 39 different groups. Most of them lived in America, but a few lived in other countries. I had them fill out a questionnaire of sort of basic demographics, and then I did a couple hour interviews, most of them by phone because I didn't have the money to travel anywhere. But the ones who lived in California, for most of them, I was able to interview them in person. And so from that, I used my bounded choice framework, those four characteristics that I talked about earlier, and sort of built the chapters around that to sort of show how they lived through those four characteristics in the group they were in. And then the latter part of the book is talking about sort of their experiences when they got out and the things that helped them and the things that didn't help them. And of course, one of the things that didn't help them is that we have absolutely no resources in our society to help these people. You know, we have domestic violence shelters for women who are abused in their personal relationships, but we don't have any shelters for people coming out of cults. We don't have many therapists or social workers or first line responders who understand the after effects of growing up in one of these groups and the kind of trauma that people experience and the PTSD symptoms. And so, you know, one of the things almost every one of them spoke about was, you know, the need for teachers and therapists who understand, because they would get, you know, these people would get out. Sometimes they didn't even know their real name. And so they didn't know how to get driver's licenses, or they didn't know how to go to school, or they didn't know about a GED, because most of them were homeschooled. So they really had no kind of education whatsoever. A lot of them ended up on the streets. And yet they all survived. I mean, the resilience was also incredible to see through these interviews. But what troubles me most about this population, and I'd say this is the biggest population coming out of cults right now, are the people who were born in. And the saddest thing, the most tragic thing, are the numbers of suicides. The suicides are just rampant. You know, and several groups have, you know, certainly the Jehovah's Witnesses, especially the gay Jehovah's Witnesses, which is another article I wrote about, gay ex-Jehovah's Witnesses, the Children of God, some of the groups that were really brutal in the dealings with the children. And some of the former members from these groups, I mean, what's great is that many of these groups have set up their own websites and some of them have scholarship funds and things like that. But some of them are actually keeping lists and keeping track of how many suicides there have been. And it's just, you know, it's a public health issue. It really is that as a society, we're just not dealing with. And it's something I feel really passionate about.
And I'm glad that you have brought this to the forefront. And I really recommend that people check out your book. And as I mentioned at the beginning, I've seen a couple of videos that you did. Some of them are longer than the opportunity that we had today. So I seriously recommend that people do a search and find your videos and watch them.
Oh, thank you. And also, just if I might mention my website, it's www.cultresearch.org. Pretty easy to remember. And there's a lot of material on there of things I've written or places I've been interviewed, things like that.
Where can someone go for help?
Well, it depends on where they live, and it depends on what kind of help they need. There are, in some areas, there are support groups for former cult members. Like there's one that a colleague of mine runs in Marin County, and here in California. I would say the main thing to do is try to find other former cult members, either of your group or other groups, who can help you. I mean, look online. There's one organization in the country called the International Cultic Studies Association, which I have some differences with, but they do put on a conference every year, and a lot of people connect at those conferences. Get books, you know, get the books that are out there especially mine. And I only say that because especially both Take Back Your Life and Escaping Utopia are written for the general public. They're not academic books. And so they're easy to read.
Yes, I recommend that too.
Yeah, there's a lot of helpful material, especially in Take Back Your Life, of different exercises and things you can do. And, you know, try to find a good therapist. And if the therapist doesn't know about cults, have them read the books. And if they won't read the books, then they're not a good therapist for you.
Yes. Right.
So, I mean, those are some of the things I would recommend.
Great. And we do have the secular therapist program with Recovering from Religion. So if anybody needs that, you can find more help on the Recovering from Religion website.
Oh, great.
Yanya, thank you so much for being a guest on our show and talking with us. We could go on. I still have a list of questions we didn't get to. But
thanks.
If people can check out the website, get the books that were mentioned, look at the videos. There's a lot of information out there, and it's fabulous information. So
great. Thanks. And thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Not just for being here, but as I mentioned, so much of what you said has opened up my eyes to things. I really appreciate you.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure for me to be here today.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering from Religion website. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be right back.